May 4th, 1970. Kent State University in Kent, Ohio. There's a mass protest against the bombing of neutral Cambodia by the United States military. 28 National Guard soldiers fire approximately 67 rounds over a period of 13 seconds, killing 4 unarmed students and wounding 9 others, one of whom suffered permanent paralysis. Seventeen days later, May 21st, 1970, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young record Ohio, called the greatest protest song of all time. Neil Young termed the Kent State massacre as probably the biggest lesson ever learned at an American place of learning. David Crosby cried when they finished the take. He can be heard keening on the fade. Four, why? Why did they die? How many more? We just embarked on a new decade, 2020. How will we define this decade? Will we be meek? Will we turn a blind eye? Will we descend to nihilism? Or will we go into the woods and write a song and make it the greatest protest song of all time? Let's stand up and fight. And proclaim to the country and to the world that we are human beings. Welcome, beautiful world, to Barbarian Noetics, the podcast dedicated to the human spirit. I'm your host, Conan Tanner. What's up, everybody? Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for tuning in. This is lucky number 30, so it is a seminal episode. It's an important episode, and it's an episode that I'm super excited to share with y'all because it was an interview that I really, really enjoyed, and I learned so much, and I hope that you all take away some knowledge as well. So my guest today is Kari Towering. And she is a Nordic folk musician, cultural educator, and spiritual leader living in Minneapolis. So I've been looking for a runic scholar to bring on the podcast, and I've contacted many, many people, and Kari was kind enough to take some of her time and to come on the pod. I'm really grateful. And Kari began studying the Elder Futhark, which is the alphabet that makes up the Nordic runes, and Norse mythological poetry as an undergraduate at the University of St. Thomas in 1989. Plunging her identity as a Norwegian-American into a time before Lefse and coffee was life-changing. This self-study informed her artistic life in the most profound way in 2003, when she began reconstructing the ways of the Volva, or staff-carrying woman of her heritage. A volva is a staff-carrying woman in the Old Norse language. Kari carries the staff of Old Norse history and tradition for her family of origin, greater community in Minnesota, and the folk art community that sustains her work. As an artist, Kari combines her deep scholarship and immersion in the traditional folk music and dance community to create new interpretations of what it means to be Nordic. Volvastav is Kari's original Nordic spiritual system, which teaches aligning the body with the cosmic world tree through the use of staff rhythm for journey and rune expression. Her Volvastav manual is available as a free download along accompanying videos on YouTube. She has many students across the United States and Scandinavia. The Volvastav Guild is a group of 8 women who use this methodology in their personal, professional, and community practices in Minnesota and Wisconsin. So that's a little snippet of my guest today, and that's all comes from her website, which you should definitely check out, www.karitowering.com. So that's KARITAURING.com. Kari is an absolute wealth of knowledge and wisdom, and her connection with her culture and her history is a beautiful thing to behold. Kari speaks about the Nordic people, but the spirit of her message is universal. So, may we all connect more deeply with our ancestors, and with our history and ways, and may we bring that knowing into the present moment and manifest that light in our eyes as we bear witness to the modern world. Without further ado, I am so happy to introduce y'all to the fantastic Kari Towering.
I guess we can jump right into it then. First off, I'm just like morbidly curious, what's the weather like in Minnesota right now?
Well, you know, yesterday was perfect skiing weather. It was really, really below zero before that. And then yesterday I went out for a ski. It was about 22 degrees, which was just felt like a heat wave because it was a 30 degree warm up. this from before. And now, and we're supposed to be getting this heat wave, which is really disappointing, because if it gets too much above 26 degrees, then skiing isn't so great. The snow, the texture of the snow just is like a gas station slushy, you know, it's just, it's not great.
So do you do cross country skiing, or do you guys have like,
I do.
Okay.
Yeah, I do cross country skiing, but we do have quite a few downhill opportunities. We have some pretty good, the glaciers really carved it up around here. So we've got some pretty steep hills, not mountainous areas, but some pretty good hills, some pretty good hills. But I'm not really a downhill skier at all. I did some downhill in high school, but I don't like to skate, and I don't like to downhill ski. I don't like things strapped to my foot that I can't get my heel off of. So with cross country skiing, it's just the toe that's locked in. So there's, I don't know, it's, could be a past life thing. I don't know what it is, but I'm like, ah.
my mom, I live out in Phoenix, Arizona. And I grew up in Chicago, so my family is all from Chicago as well, but they all just followed me out to the valley like within the last 2 years. And now my sister and my nieces and my parents are all out just like 30 minutes away from me. It's really nice. And so my mom, my brother-in-law and I helped her and my dad move out, like pack the truck and everything. And she has these huge old wooden skis that were her grandfather's cross-country skis. And she has them hanging up now in her new place in Arizona to kind of help to connect her to her roots also.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. I still use sort of an old 3-pin binding. I have a pair of those old, big, heavy wooden skis, and they're really good for going across lakes. Or pastures, like long, straight. But I also have some that are shorter so that I can go through the woods.
Interesting. So why are the long, heavy wooden ones good for crossing lakes?
They are, because of the length of them, they just spread your weight out more. The shorter skis, you sink a little bit deeper, and for me anyway, it's a little harder slog to go along straight distances with the shorter ski, especially if we're, you know, cutting, if you're talking about groomed trails, then, you know, it doesn't make a difference, but I usually avoid groomed trails and other people when I'm skiing.
Right. Yeah. No, that's cool. it's interesting because you figure that the heavier the skis, because when you say crossing lakes, you're talking about crossing frozen lakes, right?
Yes.
I guess that was an obvious. The wooden skis float on the water.
You know, otherwise you put them behind a boat and you get pulled across, and that's something we do here a lot too with all our lakes, but...
Oh,
you know,
cool.
Doing water skiing. We do a lot of water skiing.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, so, but no, in the winter, I did a ski across the bay of Lake Superior, and was glad I had a little bit longer ski because it gave me a little longer stride, and it, even though it was on a groomed trail, it was nice to have the older ski, I thought.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Nice. Yeah. So I just wanted to start off, I just wanted to learn a little bit about you. For example, like, where did you grow up?
Yeah, so I grew up here in Minnesota. I was born in the house my parents still live in, just on the outskirts of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And went to school in Minnesota. We had a, I was born in 1966, so during the 70s, the ethnic mix out in Wayzata leaned heavily towards Finnish and Scandinavian people. And so we had a sense of our roots and heritage and identity just sort of in general as a as people growing up together. And then my mother's people came from Wisconsin, Frederick, Wisconsin, and they were farmers. And both her mother and father are Norwegian. And so we spent summers on the farm and have a very heavily Norwegian-American identity. As I was growing up, I just sort of, people would say, what are you? And I'd say, I'm Norwegian. What are you? I'm Irish. What are you? I'm Finnish. You know, so we had this sort of a connection to our pre-American root system.
For sure.
I don't think that's, the more I've traveled around the United States, the more I understand that that's a pretty rare thing.
Yeah, I think so for sure. I mean, certainly living out in Phoenix, everyone is a transplant out here for the most part. So, so were your, it was your grandparents were born in Norway?
My grandfather was born in Norway and he came, with his whole family when he was 13, he and his twin brother and his parents, and they came from, a town called Fannrem in south Trondelag area, and they came to the area of Wisconsin that my grandmother's people were living in. My grandmother's people came earlier. Her grandmother was Olina. And Olina and my grandma's mother, Thea, was three when they came. And she and her husband and child came. And they were from Sognefjord area. And Olina was the only person who left the High Mountain Farm. And so when I went back to visit, I was talking to a third cousin, and as we're hiking up to the main farm, which is like 500 feet straight up, you know, and he said that I said it was so long ago that Olina left, and my mom wasn't sure if anyone remembered her, and he's like, oh, of course we remembered Olina. She's the little daughter who left us, you know. And it was just really intense. And then he's like, up at the setter, or the upper farm, the summer farm, there's a little pond named Olina's Vatnet, which is named after her. And where the mountains come together is called Olina's Skaret, which is which was named after her as well. So I've, of course, you know, I didn't have time to climb the rest of the way, you know, up. It was another day's hike. Mm-hmm. So I went back in 2016, I guess, was when I went. I can't remember. I've been back and forth a lot of times to visit relatives and stuff. So, but anyway, I got to go up to the top and to lay on, to actually do Utteset on the mound, between the setter buildings. And I heard a tune come up out of the mound.
Wow.
And I was able to, grab my iPod Touch and record what I was hearing. Like, I sang back what I was hearing.
Wow.
It was pretty amazing.
That is so powerful.
Yeah, it was really something. You know, and so I feel, you know, I was born in 1966, and my 10th great grandmother from down Olena's side, that's my whole mitochondrial lineage, and she was Ingeborg, and she was born in 1666. So.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so I know I'm, on the one hand, I know I'm sort of rare because how many people, like, have all the names of 300 years of grandmothers, you know?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I have a really big family, so there are lots of us. I have four sisters that can all do this, and all my girl cousins can do this, you know? So
wow.
In my own family of origin, I'm not very unique.
Yeah. So I guess that sort of answers my next question, which was, mm-hmm. It sounds like that you were from the jump very connected with your Norwegian heritage, like it was important to your parents to raise you that way.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And my grandfather died before I was born. So that's always, feels sad to me, but I knew my grandmother very, very well, and we spent a lot of time, and, you know, was able to talk with her a lot about the things that I was interested in, like, you know, fairies and nature spirits and charms and different things. And she was, while we had a very, very Lutheran identity, there's the three L's of Norwegian identity in America, and that's Lefse, Lutefisk, and Lutheranism. And those are like this sort of strong sort of veneer over the top of our identity that's hard to pierce beneath.
Yes.
For people who don't know, Lefse is a potato, kind of flat potato tortilla type thing. And
oh, it's so good. I love Lefse.
Yeah. And then Lutefisk is a super old way of drying cod with lye. And so you have to soak the lye out of the fish, and it's pretty strong smelling stuff. And
I imagine.
Yeah, so when people from Norway come to visit, they're like, why do you still eat lutefisk? You know, there's other ways of curing fish. But for immigrant families, when we were in the 1860s and you know, you had to prove that you could feed yourself for 3 months or they wouldn't let you on the ship. And so lutefisk and lefse were two of the staples that proved that they could come to this country. I mean, it was the thing that really that got us here. It was the gold, really, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So in our side of the pond, we still have these deep connections or attachments to those pieces that they don't have in Norway, because why would they?
Right. So what is the process of what's the process of curing the fish with the lye?
Oh my gosh. I think you're just going to have to Google that, because I don't know anyone who actually cures it that way anymore. You just buy it already soaked and ready to go.
Oh, I see. Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
That'll be a fun DIY project.
Right? Right. Yeah. So, you know, but it's a pretty old thing to cure with lye. Lye was one of those, you know, things that humans discovered quickly, because all it is really the soft white ash soaked in water creates that lye. And so all you have to do is add a little animal fat and you've got soap.
Oh, wow. I did not know that. Okay. That's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and birch ash makes the best lye for soap making and for fish curing.
Cool. Yeah. And I know the birch is like a very significant tree. At least I know there's the one root, Bercana. And if I pronounce, I'm probably pronouncing all these things wrong. So feel free to correct me if you hear my pronunciation.
Well, you know, and with that, I always tell people, hey, you know, it depends on what side of the fjord you're on, how you pronounce things, you know.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
It's different in different regions. It's different in Iceland than in Norway than in Sweden. You know, so I think people need to just, you know, it's better to mispronounce someone's name than to not say it at all for fear you won't pronounce it correctly. So
that's actually a very beautiful and deep sentiment. I totally agree with that. It's like you sort of, I went through a similar process when I started the podcast. You have to start somewhere and you have to be okay with getting it wrong. Like no matter what you're doing, anytime you start something new or try to expand your horizons.
That is right. Yeah, that's quite true. So the birch tree has been a sacred tree to every culture that lives above the 45th parallel of latitude. So the 45th parallel of latitude is called the birch line, and it's halfway between the North Pole and the equator. And the 45th parallel of latitude runs like right by the house I grew up in.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of fun. And it runs down Broadway Avenue in Minneapolis and goes around the whole world. So, and it's the birch trees, prefer to grow around or above that parallel of latitude, which is why you don't see them growing in Iowa or further south.
Interesting.
Yeah, they need the cold. They're like the reindeer. If it starts warming too much, they start to disappear and move north.
Right. do you have, are you someone who like makes your own talismans, or have you like made anything out of birch bark or birch wood?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, you know, my husband's been making rune sets for me to sell it at markets and things around here, and he uses birch and does the wood burning, and oh, it smells so good when you wood burn birch. It's the most fragrant thing, and of course the birch leaves we gather in the summertime to make vika or whisks for sauna. Because the birch leaf is, it creates a soap on its own, mixed with steam, the birch oil.
Oh, interesting. That's cool.
Yeah. Birch oil is super medicinal and super antibacterial and antimicrobial. And so we use the birch that way. And we use the birch bark to make ornaments for the Yule tree, and we use the burn birch wood for our in our wood stove, and it's pretty much the wood of choice.
Yeah. Do you guys have a sauna of your own?
Not in Minneapolis. I don't. Which is it's something that I've been really yearning for. There's sort of three things to me that are necessary for people to be happy in life, and one is a wood stove, and one is a piano, and one is a sauna.
I love that so much. A wood stove, a piano, and a sauna.
Yeah. So I have a wood stove and a piano, but I don't have a sauna in town yet. But the Volvastov Guild is, we have a lot of saunas that we can use in Minneapolis. There is access, But the Volvostov Guild is my guild of women who are practicing the Volvostov method. We are going to be starting a fundraiser in the new year to buy our own portable sauna. Because one of the things that we do is we are busy sort of researching and reconstructing the sauna rituals for healing and for rites of passage, and you know, so we need our own. There's a huge need in the community for people to use sauna for healing and for rituals. So
yeah, let me know when you do the fundraiser, because I'd like to use some of the Patreon funds for my podcast to help support that. I think that I can think of nothing better to use those funds for.
Oh, thank you so much. That's very generous.
No, it would be my pleasure. I've done a lot of sweat lodges in my life, and it always strikes me the similarities between the sauna and the sweat lodge. And that's something that is a personal interest of mine, is like learning more about the traditional kind of healing and ritualistic uses of the sauna in the Nordic tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's we have a lot of good information coming from Finland through the Finno-Ugric tradition and language. And so I sent you a song at sort of last minute that I don't know if you got it or not, but it's
I did.
So that is a Vodic women's ritual, whisking of the bride before her sauna, and then the four waters that are poured onto the sauna for her, which is like really puts the meaning of bridal shower into perspective.
Right. You know? Yeah, totally.
Like, oh, that's what a bridal shower is. You actually go in and sweat, and there are ritual waters. So water from the sea is for wisdom, water from the brook is for luck, you know, just different things. So so we have a lot of information that was preserved in the folk culture of the Finno-Ugric traditions. And then in the Baltic tradition, the Pirtes is the name of the sweat for Baltic tradition. And there are hundreds of songs about or that are to be sung in Pirts or Pirtes. One of the ones that I perform is calling the goddess Laima and Mara to come to the Pirts for the birthing.
Oh, wow.
Because you give birth in the sauna, and people are like, wow, that would be pretty hot, wouldn't it? And it's like, well, so first of all, you heat the sauna up because it is the most sterile place on the farm.
Oh, right.
And then after the sauna is heated up and cleaned, then it cools off, it's sterilized, and then you can give birth there.
Oh, right. Okay. Wow, that makes so much
right.
sense. Oh, this is so cool, Kari. I'm learning so much already. I really, really appreciate this so much. This is like medicine for me.
You're welcome. Yeah, it is. It is medicine. It is. And it's, you know, our Northern European medicine. So in Norway and Sweden and Denmark, we had what was called the Bada Husit, or the bathhouse. And because of Christianization, and then particularly during Puritanism, we just lost a lot of our traditions that weren't preserved. And it's interesting, because one of the reasons that the folk traditions stayed or were preserved in the Baltics and in Finland was because of the Soviet Union.
Oh, interesting.
Because the Soviet Union came in, and of course they oppressed everybody horribly, mm-hmm. and genocided people horribly, but they didn't care so much about folk traditions. They just wanted to make sure no one was doing Christianity or other religion.
Oh, interesting. That's fascinating.
Yeah, so there was this sort of undercurrent of folk identity that that people, the older people, held on to, and they didn't display it because it wasn't safe to talk about it, but because it wasn't connected to the institutions of the church or the education system, it stayed alive. And so then once the Soviet Union was broken up, all of these countries began, they had a flourishing of their old folk traditions, their old folk traditional songs and dances, and it's in the songs and dances that the rituals are preserved.
Hmm, cool. I wanted to ask you to extrapolate, you mentioned it once already, but the Vulva Stav tradition, the cosmology that you practice, would you please explain, because you are a vulva, would you explain what a vulva is, and then could you talk about that cosmology a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of to pull it back historically in my own life, while I had a strong Norwegian identity, like I said, there was this veneer of, you know, Lutheranism that I just couldn't get underneath until I was in college. And in the late 80s, I had a linguistics professor who was like, she's like, oh, you're going to really love the lecture that I have planned. It's, you know, and I'm like, great, because linguistics is really, can be mind-boggling. And mm-hmm. she's like, blah, 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 the Indo-European and the this system of writing called the runes. And she looked at me like, I should know just what runes are. And mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't know what runes are, you know. And she said, kind of like after the class, she's like, what? You don't know what the runes are? I thought you were into your spirituality and your heritage and all that. And I was like, ooh. So I go to my grandma, Grandma, why don't we know about runes? And Grandma's like, she's like, well, that's pretty old stuff, Kari. And, you know, it's pre-Christian. And I looked my grandma straight in the eye and I said, there were pre-Christian Norwegians?
Oh, wow.
My mom just started laughing. And my mom's like, you know, they would have been Catholics, too. And I was like, what is happening to my left brain? So I was like, oh. So that's what kind of led me down the rabbit hole is like, what is this root that I feel and practice but don't even know about at the same time?
Yeah.
So in the, you know, resources back in the 80s, there weren't as many sort of books on runes as there are now. And so we go to Lisa Peschel has a very fine primer. I still say to people, hey, you just want to just dabble in the runes, you can get Lisa Peschel's book.
That's so synchronistic, Kari. You have no idea. Yeah. I had picked up that book. I had found it at a thrift store years ago. I had forgotten I had that book. Literally yesterday, for no reason, a bunch of books fell out of my storage container. And the Lisa Peschel book was on the very top of the books that fell. And I was like, oh, right. I remember that book. And I've been reading it in preparation for this interview. That's
nice.
Wild.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's fabulous. You know, I mean, of course, I recommend my own book, you know.
Absolutely.
So my book is The Runes, A Deeper Journey. I wrote a book in 2007 called The Runes, A Human Journey, which was, which I didn't know anyone else was going to read. It was just my friend who edited it, and he's like, I want your book. I'm like, I don't have a book. He's like, I want you to write a book, you know. So in 2016, I started doing a second edition, and it just kind of took on a new direction a little bit. So I just canceled the old one and called this the new one. And there's an iPhone, iPod app that goes along with it, if people are interested in that.
And what is the app called?
It's the same as the book, The Runes, A Deeper Journey. So it's
Runes, A Deeper Journey. Okay.
Yeah, the Runes, yep.
The Runes, A Deeper Journey. Yeah. Cool. That's very cool that you made an app for that. That's awesome.
Well, I mean, it was my friend David DeYoung, who was a music partner, writer, married a Finnish woman. Now I'm the godmother of their older child, and you know, so it goes. But he was like, "I want your book." "No, I don't have a book. Write a book." So now I want, this book needs to be smaller, and I want an app. What's an app? You know. But he really just like pushed it into that realm. So I'm really grateful for that. But so one of the resources, you know, that we all have as part of our broader Nordic cultural legacy is the Eddas, and the Icelandic Edda poems are, Edda means great grandmother in Old Norse.
Mm.
And so these are oral traditional poems that came most likely by their name through the great grandmother's storytellings. And the first poem in the Eddas is called the Voluspá, which means the staff-carrying woman's prophecy.
Mm.
And so Volva means staff-carrying woman, and it is a gender-specific term, and it's gender-specific in an old sense of the word, which means it is a type of... magic, but it's really, it's a type of perceiving, a way of perceiving and relating with the web of weird of the world that is, has a feminine energetic, and in Old Norse, poetics, the female energy is mythically, metaphorically, means the unseen energy that motivates an action.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the male in the mythology represents the manifestation of that unseen energetic action.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we get stories about the gods, because they are the action oriented metaphor.
Mm.
And then people don't understand that they need to go down underneath those characters and see what is the female divine force that motivates those actions.
Yeah, I always, I like to point out, and I'm going to ask you about this later as well, the yeah. divine feminine in the Nordic mythology. But, I think that people forget that Freya actually taught Odin. So Freya is,
she was kind of forced.
And then he was this very like action oriented, individual.
Right.
He was the one that actually, you know, like he gave himself the wound and hung upside down on Yggdrasil for 9 days and nine nights and discovered the runes. But that impetus of his was seeded by Freya. So it resonates with what you're saying.
Right. And that's it. It's so what it is it's an absorptive type of relationship, not an inactive, out of body, trancey thing per se, but an absorption of energy. And so people say are like, well, can men be vulvas too? And I'm like, if they are willing to be absorptive and take on that feminine energetic of absorption and absorptive perception. So there've been recently found in some of the vulva graves that the skeletons are men that were dressed as women that were doing this work.
Oh, interesting.
So, I mean, it's really hard for us to get our brains around a more non-binary concept of our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was such an implantation of the Christian overlay.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, and a particularly a post-Victorian overlay. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a very, but it was much more fluid in the minds of our ancestors. And people are like, wow, you know, Norse tradition is very binary. And it's like, well, yes, it's binary, but energetically binary.
Right. Right.
So in some of those binary ways, it's like, you know, night, the goddess night comes and births the day, and day is her son, and then day births, you know, moves for Suna, who is the goddess, and then the sun goddess, and then the sun goddess makes way for her brother, the moon, and the moon is male, and then it comes into night, the female energy. So it's like, it's energetically speaking, it reads like boy, girl, you know,
right.
But it's talking about energetically speaking, not...
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, I do feel like our society is coming around more and more to that idea. I think gender fluidity is so much more in, like, the lexicon of the collective psyche, you know, and so the old Norse were ahead of their time a little bit and pointing out that it's an energetic kind of spectrum.
Well, I think we're finally settling back into a more ancient way of perceiving ourselves.
Mm.
You know, I think that, you know, and our culture, this is an aside and so we're getting off, but the culture seems to be doing everything it can in American popular culture to hang on to, you know, this idea of gender at birth that is determined, you know, with all these baby reveal parties that have suddenly, I'm like, whoa, what the heck are you guys doing?
Yeah, I'm not really feeling baby reveal parties either.
I'm like, I think it's disgusting, to be honest with you. I think it's just the worst thing that has come up in the last couple of decades.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, anyhow, so the vulva is, you know, this pervasive female entity that comes through all of the, you know, she's the first one to speak in the Eddas. And the first thing that she says is, Hjostedek allar helgar kinder, quieten down and heed my words, you, all you sacred folk. So it's just, it is just such it just ties me to my grandmother in this way that is so visceral. It's like, yep, the first thing my grandmother would say is, everyone please be quiet. Quiet down.
I love it.
And in the quietening down, then, she names the highest and lowest kin of Heimdall. And Heimdall is the one who is born of nine mothers, nine Jotun mothers. And so he's an ancient, ancient being that is the physical manifestation of these nine Jotun energetic principles.
Mm.
You know, and so it puts the vulva into a more ancient place than where Odin is coming from. And so, yeah, and so then she says, Ekman Jotna Arumbotna. I remember the Jotun that nurtured me. Nio Manakema Nio Ivitius, you know, nine hearth fires, nine witches in the wood, nine worlds before this one. And so she's talking about this as this world in that she's describing as the ninth world of a series of worlds, and reminds the listener to the poem that this world too has a beginning, middle, and end that starts another world. You know, so,
wow.
So, yeah. So the vulva, what marks a vulva mostly is the staff that she carries. And the staff is, for me, it is the staff of origin story. And so vulva stav literally means the staff carrying woman's staff.
Okay.
And so all of my teachings start with, what is your staff? What is your family of origin? We need to be able to hold the urlog of our own family of origin first and heal that piece first, or we have no business trying to hold space for anyone else's urlog. And holding the staff for our family of origin is, it's a full-time job, you know? Because the deeper we go, I have like 300 years worth of mitochondrial grandmothers, you know? And then I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of relatives of those, of that lineage, that are living today, both in America and in Norway. You know, and all of the stories and the, and that's just with one strand of my lineage. That doesn't even include, you know, grandma's father's side or grandpa's side, you know, of Norwegian. And my own father's family of origin pieces, I also am obligated to hold those pieces as well. And those pieces are hard to hold because those pieces are fraught with a lot of trauma in my dad's side. So working with those pieces then takes a lot of time and energy. And it's a constant discovery. And so I have second cousins who have come and said, so here's what the physical ailments I'm dealing with. What do you think might be the epigenetic carriers from our heritage of this? So I've, you know, so, and then I've got two adult sons who are busy making their lives and, you know, so I've got my, you know, my husband's family and his urlog. So that's a lot of urlog for one person to hold.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know.
And would you, really quick, before you keep going, would you just describe for listeners what the urlog is?
Oh, sure. So urlog means the primal law, the layers of primal historical precedents that create who we are. A lot of times I use a spindle, a drop spindle to illustrate it because it's a good visual, but you think of the urlog as that which was spun by your parents and your grandparents and their parents and grandparents and all the way back. And it is not just genetic material, like your doctor might want to know, well, who in your family had diabetes, who in your family had heart conditions. But all of those pieces are very important, those genetic components. But also, who experienced loss, who experienced different kinds of traumas. What did you experience in the, what was the, your culture of origin experiencing? So, the loss of homeland for immigrant people coming to America is a major piece of trauma that, is in all of our Urlaub.
What's up, glorious listeners? We're going to get right back to this episode with the inspiring and incredibly knowledgeable Kari Towering. But first, a quick word from our sponsor. Today's episode of Barbarian Noetics is brought to you by Neville Goddard. Neville Lancelot Goddard was a prophet, a profoundly influential teacher, and an author. He was fascinated with metaphysics, but he didn't associate himself as a metaphysician. He was born on February 19 in 1905 in the British West Indies. And in 1922, he came to the United States on board the SS Vasari to study drama at the age of 17. He eventually met a Scotsman who lent him a series of books on the powers of the mind. And upon his return to New York, he gave up the entertainment industry to devote his full attention to the study of spiritual and mystical matters. Interestingly enough, Neville Goddard was drafted into the U.S. Army at age 38, which I'm going to be very soon. I can't imagine. I couldn't imagine being drafted in a year. It's just crazy. So he gets drafted into the U.S. Army at age 38. Which he obviously did not want, especially since he felt he was too old to become a soldier, and he had a wife and daughter at home to take care of. Through the power of imagination, as Neville told it in his March 24, 1972 lecture, he was honorably discharged after just a few weeks of training. And then one consequence of his brief army training is that he received full United States citizenship, as he was a British citizen up to that point. Now, this next part is super interesting. Neville Goddard talks about this very mysterious figure called Abdullah. And his interest in esoteric interpretations of the Bible deepened after he met Abdullah, who was an Ethiopian Jew who lectured on esoteric Christianity and taught both Goddard and Joseph Murphy. Neville went to hear him somewhat under protest to satisfy the constant urging of a friend, saying, "I recall the first night I met Abdullah. I had purposely delayed going to one of his meetings because a man whose judgment I did not trust had insisted on my attendance. At the end of the meeting, Abdullah approached me and said, 'Neville, you are 6 months late.' Startled, I questioned how he knew my name when he said, 'The brothers told me you would be here 6 months ago.' Then he added, 'I will remain until you have received all that I must give you. Then I will depart.' He too may have longed to go, but he had to wait for me." So from this introduction, Neville studied with Abdullah, learning Hebrew, the Kabbalah, and the hidden symbolic meaning of scripture. So Neville Goddard, super dope dude. I'm gonna play a little clip of one of his original audio lectures, which you can find on archive.org. If you just search Neville Goddard, I'll put it in the description of the podcast. But yeah, you can find his original audio lectures. The obviously the audio quality sometimes is hard to make out what he's saying, but there's some pretty clear ones out there. And there's some people who have taken the original audio and kind of condensed it and made it nicer and put the talks on YouTube with like a little bit nicer audio. So you can definitely find some stuff. And I recommend listening to his voice because there's something about his original voice that really conveys something. The man was, he was on to something. He was the real deal. Anyways, so yeah, I'm going to play a brief clip of Neville Goddard, and then we'll get back to the podcast with Kari Tauri.
So here is a reflection that he saw in his dream, a man prone, containing infinity, and the deadest thing he'd ever seen. God places a limitation, and then takes upon himself that limitation, and reaches in this act the very limit of contraction, that he may then expand beyond what he was. He takes upon himself the limit of opacity, and then begins to expand, and there's no limit to translucence, to transparency. This is the world called the world of death. But while we're in it, and we ourselves are animating it, we can take any state we desire. There are infinite number of states. You can be in a poor state or a wealthy state. You're no better off as far as the height goes because one is poor and one is wealthy. Not from a spiritual point of view. But while you're in the world of Caesar, why not be comfortable? Why not take a state that cushions and comforts? And so you can take a state of affluence if you know what it would be like. Were you affluent? Assume that you are, and see the world as you would see it were it true. And then, I would say accept it. Believe in the reality of that unseen, imaginal act. And if you do, it will come to pass. Because the whole vast world really is within you. I don't care what others will tell you. It's all within you. And everyone moving in your world moves because of you. William James made the statement that the greatest revolution in his time was the discovery that man, by changing the inner attitudes of his mind, could change the outer aspects of his life. Now, James belongs to our generation, this century. He's gone from the world, but he was the great educator of the 20th century. And he said the greatest revolution in his time was this discovery. Well, the great book of books, the Bible, makes that statement. Not as James made it, but how would you interpret this? Whatever you desire, believe that you have received it, and you will.
Absolutely essential for us to look at, to uncover, to think about, because it causes that unhealed trauma of not being on the land that our ancestors are buried on, gives us a bifurcation. Oftentimes, trauma creates a bifurcation in the personality. Which is left to its worst can become schizophrenic, really. But it gives us a false dichotomy of either, you're either from here or you're not from here. Mm-hmm. So, if you're from here, you get to, appropriate from all the cultures who are really from here.
Right.
Right. And if you're not from here and you don't get to have your own culture of origin, rituals and traditions, then you want to make laws against anyone having them.
Oh, wow. That is so interesting.
Yeah, so it causes this false dichotomy. And so what healing that trauma does is it allows us to crack it open further and say we can be from here and not from here mm-hmm. at the same time. We can hold both of those things and we can find roots that connect us to our cultures of origin. And we can find that in our countries of origin, but we can also find it here within the culture groups that preserve those pieces, mm-hmm. you know. And so this takes it, so this is why I think that people will get a little confused by me, maybe, is that I'm not strictly talking about going and doing this as going into heathenry. Decolonizing ourselves doesn't mean you skip over thousand years of Christianized relatives.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Decolonizing means going into those pieces and figuring out what pieces of that tradition helped them survive out here on the prairie when there was no one else around, you know?
Yeah.
You know, what pieces can we move up? So healing Urlaug in a Volvastav way means healing all of it and not skipping any of it, not skipping off into some sort of great undamaged ancestor from Ancient of Days, because that's just simply it's a spiritual bypassing of the real hard work that mm-hmm. we all really need to do.
Yeah, when you're describing the visual of the staff carrying woman's staff, I got this idea of you are sort of like the living thread that connects all of the past into the present, and it's like it's an ever unfolding story. So it's like, you know, so you now in Minnesota are creating history for the future.
Absolutely. Well said. Oh, I think that's quite spot on. Yeah. You know, and we, part of our decolonization process is to let go of the idea of a future tense. You know, and to stop looking at the norms as meaning past, present, and future, and start realizing that their names, Urd, holds the Urlaug of what is. And we are a past-looking people, a past-precedence-looking people, and it is up to us to build a good past precedence, not to build some sort of future, because we don't really have that.
Interesting.
We've got what is, Verdandi, what's becoming, and schooled, which is death, should, shilled. What it is that we are obligated to pay into the past for our being here now.
Interesting.
And the majority of what schooled holds is the necessity to heal past traumas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we should be doing.
Right. So how do you kind of understand the norns?
So the big three norns I understand as they were described in the Völuspá, as these female entities that come onto the face of creation to create, to help create time. She says, Sam como Mayer Marx Vitandi, Triathen Seir Undatulistandar. Then come these women wise in all things, three of them living under the tree. Urdu heta eine andra verdandi, skaru oskidu skuda eine srizu. They are, is one, the other becoming, scoring, possibly scoring the runes or scoring the marking things. So skaru skidu, marking things. I sometimes think of those markings as runes being scored in our bones and in our blood. Think of those markings as being the 13 stav marks on the calendar of the prim stav of the moon, 13 moons. On the ancient horn of the Lady of Lasso, from the Ice Age, right? So I don't know if you know this visual, but it's this cave, a bas relief in a cave that's way down, a long crawling on your belly kind of chute that goes into this bigger cave piece, and it's this great woman. And she's holding a horn in her right hand, and her left hand is on her womb, and she was covered in red ochre. And on the horn is 13 stav marks. And to me, there's no clearer message than that we must keep track of our moon times, that females who bleed on the moons, and the moons need to be calculated. And yes, the horn holds the medicine for us. That will help, you know, 20,000 years ago, we are the only, hope of humanity is in this piece.
Wow. Yeah. I just want to tell the listeners this story that, I recently launched a YouTube channel, which I call Barbarian Runecasts, and the idea that was that I would pull runes to kind of to decipher the pulse of the collective for a certain period of time, and I decided it just popped in my head to do it based on the rune or the moon cycles. So I would pull runes on the new moon and on the full moon, and it's like the rune cast is for the kind of the vibe for that moon cycle. And then I learned that your Patreon is you do the exact same thing, that you pull runes on the new and the full moon.
Yes.
So that blew my mind. And I would love to hear, how did you, I have an idea already, but I would love for you to extrapolate on why you chose to pull the runes on the new and the full moon.
Well, and what I call that is universally verified personal understanding. Mm. You know, the more these synchronicities happen, the more we are able to get the verification that, yep, we're on the right path. So I'd say, well done you. started a study with some other people online, a year-long study of the Primstav calendar. And the Primstav calendar is the transition calendar between the new moon agricultural calendar of Old Norse people, and it applies saint days over the top of that. So it is a transitional calendar between the pre-Christian and the Christian Catholic overlay.
Oh, interesting.
Primstav is what it's called in Latin because it's prima luna, which means first moon or the new moon. And so in Old Norse, it's nystav, which is the new moon. Ni is the NY with the little dash, that means new moon. Mm-hmm. And And the new moon was, the moon cycles were something that our traditional culture paid close attention to all the way back in the earth. There's so much evidence of our traditional cultures having moon calendars, as well as the solar, solar calendars, because our traditional lifestyle was agricultural or ranging herders. So it was essential for us to pay attention to all of those pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Deep in the Black Forest, you'll find the same sorts of standing stone circles that you find in the British Isles, based on moon cycles and sun cycles. You know, so this is really, really, really the ancient way of doing it. And that's the other thing that ties this Lady of La Salle art into the most primal, essential thing that we have and can observe, is the way the moon moves through the sky and how it comes to full and then how it diminishes.
Yeah.
So doing things on the new moon held significance all the way into the folk culture.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find writings all the way into the 1800s of when the moon is this phase, it's good to do this. And when the moon is at this phase, you know, your dreams might be prophetic. And when you know, it matches it all up. So for me, one of the most important things that we can do to decolonize ourselves is to shift from the kind of calendar system that was imposed on us.
Mm-hmm.
And that means going into a moon calendar. The first time I did this was in high school. I had a brilliant, brilliant teacher in high school, and who has since passed. Actually, many of my great inspirational people have passed away by now, but I wanted to do an independent study, and he said, well, why don't you compare the difference between the 12-month Roman calendar and a 13-moon calendar? And so I started doing this research, and lo and behold, the more I observed the moon calendar, the more my body changed, and it was affected by that.
Oh, yeah.
Suddenly my menses are syncing up. Suddenly my, you know, it really spoiled me for a regular, straight job, you know, a 9-to-5-er.
Yeah.
wow, well, it's great. Now I'm ruined for fitting into the culture because I can't go back.
Yeah.
You can't unfeel that, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, so the imposition of this 12-month calendar that doesn't actually, even though it maintains the word moon in it, it doesn't follow the moons.
Right. Right. Right.
And a 7-day week is another external imposition on the culture that came from the Roman grid work culture.
Mm-hmm.
We did not follow a 7-day week. And when a 7-day week was imposed, we lined up our deity. They, you know, negotiated with us about what deities were going to fall on those days. And
yeah.
So we have, you know, Sunadag, Manidag, Tirsdag, Wodisdag. Everybody knows those, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the sun was Suna, and the moon was Mani. Tir became the equivalent of Mars. So this is where Tir becomes the god of war, and it it diminishes here to fitting into a grid work, and so we forgot a lot of these other things that Tyr represents. And as a rune, one of the things that I've tried to do is to pull in some of those old stories that the Romans were telling about Tyr and how there was a female component, the Zisa or Isis equivalent to Tyr. So that doesn't make it into our psyche because of its association with Mars. Mm. Odin's association with Mercury, Jupiter and Thor get this association because they're big and red, so why not? You know?
Yeah.
And then that's how Freya gets locked into being a love goddess, because the equivalency of Venus.
Right.
For Friday. And it's like, you know, love is the last thing on her mind if you ever read her stories.
Mm.
What's mostly on her mind is that she is the teacher of Save and the leader of Volur. She is the leader of the Valkyries.
Mm.
You know, she has this whole entire life beyond this love goddess imposition.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what fascinates me most is Saturday. Because in English we went ahead, speaking of gender switching, so then Sunday in Spanish becomes Domingo because that's the God's day. So the gender switch of the sun and moon happens through the Romanization as well.
Mm.
Where the sun becomes masculinized and the moon becomes feminized. And that's where women's lunacy, the lunatic women, kind of stems from that piece as well. Mm. Because women were taken out of their position as the holders of the life-giving sun. Anyway, But Saturday is fascinating to me because in English we kept Saturn for Saturday, but Laurdag is what it is in the Scandinavian languages, and that translates to washing day.
Oh, okay.
So Laurdag, washing day, was so important to our ancestors that they refused a Roman equivalency.
Oh, wow.
Saturday was the day, if you ask any Finn, even still today up in Minnesota, if they go to church, they'll mm-hmm. tell you, well, we go to sauna on Saturdays.
Right.
Because sauna day was Saturday. You wash the house. You wash your clothes, you wash the barn, you wash things, and then you wash yourselves. And so it's this great coming together of the community at the bathhouse, in the sauna. This is where we commune as equals. You know, in the dark, steaming, naked, vulnerable space.
Mm-hmm.
Of the sauna. Mm-hmm. And washing, cleanliness was so important that the Vikings were off and, you know, so there's this writing in the Anglo-Saxons, the English were like, and all our women are going over to those Vikings because they're so clean and they smell so good, and they're really pissed off about that, you know. And if you look in the grave findings, you know, one of the oldest runic inscriptions is the word or name, Horja, on a comb from about 200 AD.
Whoa.
And it's funny because Horja is a name, but it also, I think it's being and I don't hear this from any of the academic sites, but hog means hair.
Mm.
So I think it also means hair, yes?
Right.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I love it.
Because it's, you know, we're wordy people. We're word poetry people. We love making jokes and kennings and nicknames for things. Hetty and kenning are two of our favorite things, and making up poems and making up, kveying is one of the folk cultural traditions that still, lasts in Norway, this, versification, poetic versification in song. And, you know, so, yeah.
Cool.
So that kind of,
I want to get
into,
I wanted to get into more about the runes, and specifically, you studied the runes, right, at University of St. Thomas. Is that what I saw?
Yes. So again, that was an independent study that was linked to a linguistics class for my English major. And it was led by, overseen by Dr. Luann Dummer, who has since passed, but is the founder of the Luann Dummer Women's Center at the University of St. Thomas. And and so at the time, you know, like I say, there were very few real resources, and the ones that I was finding were sort of like Lisa Peschel. Edred Thorson had some writing. And, of course, Llewellyn Books was right here in my community, the publishing house, you know. So I wound up finding a few books that never got published because they made their way out of Llewellyn Publishing and into secondhand bookstores, that kind of thing. And of course, I'm finding all of this material in the occult section. And I'm like, oh gosh, no wonder grandma was a little like, what do you want to study that for? You know? So, and then there was a book that got published that is, probably the worst book ever written about runes. And it's that, I'm like, oh, I don't mean to be mean-spirited, because I'm sure that it was really important for him to write his own book on his own thing, but it never should have been published for public consumption.
Right.
That Ralph Bloom book. Yeah, he's the one who invented the blank room.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So you don't think that's you don't really resonate with what he wrote in that book?
Well, the first thing he does is he takes the Elder Futhark out of its given order that we, you know, that starting with Fehu, and he starts it with manas, and every rune he describes is about being a spiritual warrior. So I'm like, you know, this is probably like a good notebook for you to keep for yourself, but it's really got nothing to do with, like, you know, runes historically or culturally. It's not couched in any real cultural context.
Interesting. So it's kind of like
the runes are culture. The runes are our culture, and it is our cultural. It is the cultural context that we have to be most diligent about, in my opinion, because otherwise we're appropriating from our own culture. We're taking it out of its context, and that's what happened within the whole, you know, Nazi tradition of taking all of our taking runes and mythology and misappropriating them from its original cultural context to mean something else and to be about something else. And that is just an abomination.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't recommend it.
Yeah. that's really educational for me. So I really appreciate it. What books would you like most recommend to myself and to listeners if they want to really learn about the runes? Obviously, your book is number one.
Yes. Yes. And I am just in the process now of doing an online course.
Okay, cool.
That really reaches into the cultural context in a way that I couldn't do with my book. So you can see me wearing my Bronze Age string skirt when I talk about Fehu and the bringing of the cattle into Scandinavia in around 2000 BCE, right? So that puts Fehu in a deeper context.
Yeah, that's awesome. How can people find out about this course?
They can go on my website at karitarn.com, and I'll have links to that. They can, it's also being done through Needfire Wellness, Needfire Academy. So that's a link people can, and I can supply links for you.
Okay.
To that.
Perfect.
So one of my other favorite books on runes is called Lady of the Northern Light, A Feminist Guide to the Runes by Susan Gitlin Emmer. And, I got this book, again, early 90s. It was published, I think, in 92. And one of the things that I love about her book is that she pulls in all of the goddesses and the feminine divine powers and connects them to the runes. So it's a great read.
Cool.
For people. It's a lot of fun to read. I think Diana Paxson's book, Taking Up the Runes, is a one that people probably want to have on their bookshelves because she also includes the existent rune poems. It's a very kind of a thorough bibliography, and she's got good scholarship. So that's one that I think people would maybe like to have on their bookshelves, and then when we're talking about the eldest Luthark, we're talking about runes that we know go back to at least 160 ACE.
Mm-hmm.
We have some mentions in Tacitus when he is describing, as a Roman historian in around 95, mm-hmm. He's describing how divination works in Norse culture.
Mm-hmm.
So he talks about the cutting of slips of wood from a fruit tree and cast out onto a white cloth, and we can't say that these were the 24 elder Futharks that they were carving, because they might have been variations on those symbols. They might have been symbols that were significant to the family of origin. We don't really know. Mm-hmm. But what is significant is this idea of asking the same question three times.
Mm, okay.
So he describes that in the family system, the male head of the household casts the runes. And if it's a decision that's supposed to be made for the entire community, then the eldest woman casts them.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah. And, of course, he's talking about one tribe amongst many. We didn't call ourselves Germans or Celts back then either. We had tribal identities, like the Ingvonians and the Longbardians and, all the Swabians and all those different tribal things. And the Germans named us, anyone east of the Danube was a German, and anyone west of the Danube was Celtoid. So So this outsider identification started pretty early for our people, our groups of people. So anyway, and it's interesting, this idea of asking three times for confirmation, because if you come to my family gathering this Yuletide, and someone offers you another piece of pie, you say, oh, no, no, thanks. And then they'll offer again, and you'll say, oh, no, I really couldn't. And then they'll offer again, and you'll say, well, I guess I could have one more. This is something that's deep in our culture, and in Minnesota, we do this all the time. It's the ask again, ask a third time, and if at that third time they say, no, really, then it's over.
Right. Okay. Got it.
And it's interesting, in the Völuspá, Odin has to ask three times, will you know more? Will you know more? Will you know more? She says.
Mm.
You know? And so, a vulva, in the Völuspáv tradition, we're so busy working on our own family of origin things that if you say, I need someone to read my orlog, or I need help building a grith contract in my family or whatever, or my kindred, we might say no, and you're obligated to ask at least twice before we say yes.
Okay.
It's just in our culture.
Yeah. Cool. I love it. How do you use the runes at all for divination? How do you do that, or?
Right. So yeah. I do. So one of the things, one of the sort of standard, rune pulls that layouts that I do is to pick runes for each of the Norns. So I pick a rune, or I'll have somebody else pick the rune. If I'm doing a reading for someone else, I have them hold the runes, shake the runes, mix them up, get balanced within their bodies, the world tree within their system, and think about the question or issue that they are really most pressed upon. And then I have them draw one for Urd, one for Verdandi, and one for Skuld. So that is the energy around what is, what the past precedence of this issue is,
mm-hmm.
and what's becoming, the things that are ripe in the universe that they can make use of. And then Skuld is what they should do.
Okay.
So when people ask questions like, will I ever get married, or, you know, things like, you know, will I ever have children, I don't use runes for yes and no very often. And I don't often talk about far future things of what can happen. I do, as the vulva in the Völuspá says, and talk about past precedents. And what is, so she tells Odin, here's the origin of the world. Here is your origin. Here are the things that you've done. I know where your eye is hid. I know you hung on the windswept tree. I know who you have, you know, what oaths you've broken and who your blood brother is. I know all of these pieces. Mm. I know how you treated the goddesses of creation. I know all these pieces.
Mm.
And what is happening now is the opening up of the end of Odin. And the prediction is what should happen in order for the Shield to be paid. He should be consumed.
Mm.
Each of the mythic gods as representations of mythic understandings is consumed, if chaos, the wolf representing greed, and if these things should be unleashed in the world, then it is fitting that Odin, whose name means the spirit, should be consumed by the chaos wolf, and that the next generation, Vidar, broad perspective, who is the son of Odin and Grit, Grit meaning truth, and Odin meaning the spirit, truth and the spirit birth Vidar, broad perspective, and broad perspective is what calms chaos and destroys chaos and creates a new world.
Wow. Yeah. Did you see that kind of like playing out all like in the modern world?
Yeah, I do. You know, I absolutely do. And I see Ragnarok as playing out in our lives on a daily basis. Every time the sun goes down, it's a little Ragnarok for us to come and rebirth ourselves in a new way. And but culturally, you know, it's very, very similar to what is described by the vulva in what, you know, that brothers will fight against brothers, you know, families are being ripped apart by this complete bipolar false dichotomy of a world that we are living in.
Yeah.
And once we have an us and them mentality, we have begun our own Ragnarok journey.
Mm-hmm. But then, of course, it's like ultimately, it's hopeful because there's always the rebirth.
Mm. Yes, and it is. It's also hopeful because, you know, this is only one aspect of the Norse pantheon that is undergoing Ragnarok. It says nothing about Njord or Freya or, you know, this is really all about Odin and his lineage.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
So for those of us, part of what Volvastav teaches is a way of aligning our bodies with the world tree, becoming the world tree ourselves, and maintaining our core as the axis mundi, so that the world's axis, so that we can see the chaos going on around us, but we maintain our presence of mind and our completeness of being in the core of the tree. We are Ask and Embla. We are Leaf and Leafdrasser. We are in the center of the tree, experiencing what is happening around us, but not being swept up into it. I always recommend, you were talking about recommendations, always recommend Maria Krilhaug's book, Feet of Yggdrasil, and her beautifully done master's thesis, which she has provided for people for free online, called The Maiden with the Mead. And it's, you know, really, she's just such a brilliant scholar, Norwegian woman. And I've known her work for quite a few years, I think since 2008 or 9, when my Vulva Song CD came out, and she used one of my pieces from that on one of her videos. And she's got Lady of the Labyrinth is her YouTube site, and boy, she is just wonderful, just brilliant. I just, Seed of Yggdrasil takes takes apart the mythology, and she has been on the forefront of translating God names and place names into English so that we can understand them the way native language speakers would understand them.
And what's her name again?
Maria Kvilha, K-V-I-L-L-H-A-U-G.
Okay.
And so she talks about Odin and his brothers, Vili and Ve, and translates their names to the spirit, will, and holiness. So one of the pieces that I work with in Volvastava as a healing technique is the understanding of the vagus nerve as being, so vagus means wandering, the wandering nerve that goes from our face down to our lower gut and up again and has branches at the heart and the gut area.
Mm-hmm.
And the wandering god is Odin. Odin is the wandering god, and Odin, the spirit, wanders through the vagus nerve, greeting his brothers, Vili, who is will, at the will center in the gut, and Ve, which is holiness, at the heart center. And so it's through breath and stav, rhythm, and chant that we can maintain an alignment with the world tree that begins to heal that pathway of the vagus nerve, the spirit's own pathway of our own body's ability to stay out of panic mode and out of anxiety and to have that feeling of unity. Yeah,
and I really do feel as though, like, when you do that sort of work on an individual level, you are like really helping to heal the collective, and also kind of help heal the biodiversity on our planet, our home planet, you know. And it's like it's such an apt metaphor as we talk about the resurgence or the remembering of the divine feminine, and that includes the inner feminine within, you know, anatomical men, and you know, bringing about essentially like a new world, you know, as we use renewable energy and our consciousness starts to shift more towards collaboration instead of competition. And I really do believe that we can really help that process by doing that work within ourselves.
I absolutely agree. And what's more, we have to start with doing that work ourselves. It's
right.
Really the only thing that we're obligated to do. And so, again, you know, when someone comes to me and says, I want to be a vulva, you know, will you train me? I say, well, first let's start out with, who are your parents? What's your relationship like with them? You know, and people get a little confused by that work because they are used to looking outside of themselves. People are coming from this place of looking outside of our own selves for all the answers. And what we need to do really is, as you said, move deeper within and experience the majesty of mythic metaphor in our own being first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know that I want to respect your time. We've gone for quite a while. Do you have like 5 more minutes or?
Oh, I do. Yeah. I love this stuff.
Okay, cool. We really appreciate it. So I wanted to ask you about, you know, we've touched on, and this is a little bit of a pivot in the conversation. So we've touched on, you know, cultural appropriation and the importance of healing our own orlog and, mm-hmm. and, you know, looking to our own ancestry for our cultural context. And, so I was talking with a friend a few months ago, and the idea of, spirit animals came up, and she was saying that, this idea of, you know, people using the term spirit animal is kind of seen sometimes cultural appropriation of certain Native American traditions, which I totally respect. And then I was thinking, though, like, so I guess I wanted to ask you, is there a tradition of, like, animal totems or animal familiars in the Nordic tradition?
So absolutely there is. And when I, one of the things that we can do to help ourselves talk about our own culture is to learn the words for those things in our own culture of origin languages.
Mm-hmm.
And that will help. And people are like, well, English is my culture of origin languages, you know, language. So things like smudge is something that actually comes from Old English, and it means a pot of burning herbs. Mm-hmm. But it has become identified with Native American culture, and people have been asked not to use it because it's appropriative to Native American culture.
Oh, interesting.
So instead of using smudge, even though it comes from Old English and was brought to this country with immigrants, I'm like, that's okay. My culture's taken plenty from you. You can have that one, you know.
Right.
In Norwegian, it's called Østerøyk, herbal smoke. So I will just use Østerøyk. And when I talk about following spirits, I will talk about Silja, you know. Mm. And I will just use the words from our own culture to describe them. And not only does it help to separate this idea of appropriation, but it helps to deepen our own sense of what those things actually mean.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So you were saying that there is...
It doesn't get at the depth of what a philia is anyway, right? Because a philia is a following spirit. It means a follower spirit.
Mm.
And so so there are different forms that our following spirit can take. Oftentimes, it might take the form of one of our ancestors. Sometimes it takes the form of an animal. So that's one way that we have connection to animal spirit as part of our soul complex, right? So this isn't just like I'm from the clan of what and what, but we have that too. If you go back and you look at all the old knightly badges and things, you will oftentimes find family crests that include animals because animal identification was part of family of origin. So sometimes, so people who maybe had a wild boar was associated with Freyr and the wild boar helmets and the wild boar on the you know, connects our family of origin to a deity who is considered the genesis of our family, our eight.
Mm.
We also had, you know, groups of spiritual warriors that would take the forms of other, of creatures like the berserk, the bear shirt warriors. And so they appear as though they were bears, you know. So there's that, and the wolf, Ulfsirk, and, you know, so that's part of the boar, the wolf, and the bear are like clans of warriors as well. So that goes way back into Viking, pre-Viking times. And then we have our hamur and our haminya. So those are parts of our soul and our body complex that can take the form of an animal with practice. Sometimes that's something that can be, that can go forward in time or appear like there's a folk story about this gal. She saw one of the elders coming up the mountain, and she ran in to put the coffee pot on and waited and waited and waited, and the woman never came. And so she went down the mountain to see what happened and found out the woman had died, and it was her Hamina that had come forward up the mountain.
Okay.
You know, yeah, so we have all these, and we've got all these runes that represent animals, right? We've got Sehu representing all these domestic animals, and Urus, the wild bison. We've got all of these pieces that are truly ours that we need not compare to other cultures if we sink into our own culture.
Mm-hmm. Isn't the movement rune associated with an animal?
Well, there's the horse.
The horse, yeah.
There is a rune for the horse, which is, you know, one of the most magical creatures that we had in our culture. You know, all the gods, you know, had horses that were attached to them as vehicles for them to travel. There was the wild horses that lived on the plains, on the Ida Plain, you know, and the horse that draws the sun disk across the sky. I mean, there are loads and loads of animals, magical animals that are attached. There's all the animals of the world tree too. We've got four winged deer. We've got an elk at the top. We've got a goat on top of Valhalla who's, you know, milking out mead for the Ainjara. We've got the Nidgahog and all the snakes beneath the primordial dragons beneath the world tree. We've got the Ratatoskr that goes up and down. We've got birds.
The Ratatoskr.
I know. So the squirrel was one of my very first, was one of the very first animals that ever really connected to me in that way. And I was probably three, and I was out in the sandbox out back, and my Aunt Dee from Tennessee, she's the one who always tells the story, and there was a blood-curdling scream, and we all ran out, and we said, Kari, what's going on? And you said, a squirrel looked at me, and we laughed and laughed, and I'm like, yeah, but you don't know the look that squirrel gave me, and what I read, and what I heard, you know, and that was something that stayed with me for a long time.
So what did, even as a three-year-old, you felt like the squirrel was communicating with you?
Oh, it absolutely was. And I have, you know, it's one of my earliest memories, you know, of looking eye to eye with this squirrel and having this squirrel just sort of give me this sort of message in my mind of like, hey, these are my acorns, you know? Sort of like this. I was like, whoa, you know, of course, we had lots of acorns around. I lived it was an oak savanna when we moved there that we lived in. Now it's a shopping mall, but lived in an oak savanna and used the acorns as little cups for our Barbie dolls and all the little things, you know, and so I had a stockpile of acorns and I was using them as little cars to go around my road work in the sandbox, and the squirrel just came up and looked at me like, you know, what are you doing? These are my acorns. And I was like, what?
Love it.
Funny.
You use the term following spirit. And that's a term I've not heard that before. Would you extrapolate on that?
Yeah. So, a spirit, when we are born, the Norns are obligated to come twice in our lives, when we're born and when we die. And That's the big N Norns. But then there are all these little N Norns as well that are Valkyrie and Vissir, deified female ancestors, other following spirits that might go into that category. And for most people, their Valkyrie, their Vissir, their female deified ancestors appear also at their birth and at their death, but mostly at their birth. And if we maintain a relationship with them throughout our lives, they can help help us direct the spin of our Urlog. And it increases the soul piece that we inherit, which has to do with luck.
Okay.
And if we don't maintain a relationship with them, they go into a sleep or a stupor. And this is where the imagery of the sleeping Valkyrie kind of comes from, or the sleeping beauty that pricks her finger and falls into a sleep, the sleeping thorn that Odin gives to Sigurdrifa. And that female deified part of ourselves has to be woken up. And it takes a heroic act, a fearless, heroic part of self to do that. So we need to be both our fearless hero and our sleeping Valkyrie. We need to do the work to wake the Valkyrie up, to bring her back into an active part of our lives. Because it's through her that we get the drink of memory mead and of wisdom mead, the golden drink of wisdom. So our following spirit can oftentimes be this Vissir or this Norn that follows us through our lives. There's also a spirit that follows families of, and we have little names for some of those called Nissa or Narin or Tomte or Tomtu. The Nissa is a spirit that follows the family and takes care of the cattle and the livestock that we bring into the barn during the winter. And so we have to, on Christmas Eve, we have to feed the Nissa a porridge, a julegrut, with a pat of butter on it in order to keep the relationship going.
What kind of a porridge do you feed?
Well, these days it's rice pudding. Back in the earliest times, it was probably something more like rumagrut, which is a sour cream and flour porridge. Or maybe, so one of the oldest dishes of Europe is a grain porridge made with barley or einkorn or one of these old grains that is soaked in milk and boiled down, and sometimes it's flavored with rose water.
And, ooh,
nice. Yeah, it's lovely. There's a really lovely Ukrainian recipe that I use sometimes. But yeah, and so, and you got to have a pat of butter on it because what it does is it's taking the products of the cow, creating a dish, and sharing it with the land white so that they will in turn take care of the cow. And it makes a cycle, a complete cycle.
Mm-hmm. One last question. Oh, sorry. Were you going to say something?
Oh, go ahead. Well, I was going to talk about the Huldra, too, and how these cow-tailed fairy people from Scandinavia, it was said that sometimes they came to this country hiding in the trunks, these old steamer trunks that were highly decorated with the Rosmaling, the Scandinavian style painting. And a friend of mine in Oklahoma, who is a Cherokee singer, songwriter, Michelle Mays, she said, "Oh, is that what those critters are called? We had to make up a name for them because we'd never seen them before." So there's a name for Huldra in Cherokee, which I never actually got from her because the person she was going to ask had passed away. So this is a way of healing the concept of we can be from our, we can have a root in our native European origin places and be from here and maintain our traditions and not appropriate and not make laws against other people's languages and cultures and traditions, because we can have both.
Yeah.
Once we break through that false dichotomy, the healing can start.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you're so right too on it. When one is kind of comfortable in one's own cultural heritage, you don't begrudge others then. That is very, very true. Really quick before I ask the last question, what are the name of the little fairy people again?
Oh, so Nissa, N-I-S-S-E, is one of them that we use at Christmas time. Also the Haugebund, which is the mound farmer, the dead farmer that was the first farmer on the land. We have rituals for that Haugebund, but those mounds are actually in Europe, usually because people weren't buried on their farms once they got to this country. And then the Huldra, H-U-L-D-R-E, Huldra. Yeah.
And do they have like a certain type of archetypal form that they take, or are they shapeshifters?
They do. Yeah, they do. And each culture is a little bit different. So there's billions of other fairy creatures, but in Norway, the Huldra, when you have the A at the end, it's the female fairy creatures, and they have cow's tails. And some of the folk stories about them is that if a Huldra can get a human man to marry her in a church, that she'll lose her cow's tail. That's one of those old things from the 1800s, you know, and that still exists. And then the Huldu are the males. And there's the Nishin. So one of my albums is called Nikken and Bear, the Nishin and the Bjorn, the water spirit and the bear spirit.
Mm.
That's one of my albums from 2013. And one side, I was thinking of it as an album. Side A is the Nikken, you know, and then the other half is about the bear spirit and the folk songs around the bear spirit. And then I have an album called Ljós, which is the light elf spirits that are spirits of the summertime and spirits that seek the sun.
Mm.
And then there's an album called Svart, which means black, which is the underground elves that stay away from the sun. And those are darker, more underground winter types of songs. So if people are interested in hearing some of those folk songs and things, they can go on my website and look at those albums. And each of my albums has a free downloadable scholarly notes.
Mm-hmm.
So so for Svart, there's like 33 pages of scholarly notes.
Yeah, it's
available.
Really, I was reading it. It's fascinating. I really encourage my listeners to check out Kari's website, KariTowering.com. Yeah, and there's so many resources there and ways we can support you too.
Thank you. Yeah.
And you have a Patreon. How do people reach your Patreon?
Yeah, I just put everything under my name, Kari Towering. So if you just look up Kari Towering, you'll find my website, you'll find my Patreon, you'll find my Facebook, my YouTube stuff, all of that stuff. And I have just, I've put a lot of content out there for free for people because it comes from our shared cultural heritage. And so there are, I think there's an urgency for people to start connecting in a meaningful way. And so I wanted to make a lot of my earliest work, especially free, so that people can just start digging in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really beautiful and generous of you. So as we kind of bring the interview to a close, I wanted to ask you, so you were talking about waking the Valkyrie, waking the sleeping Valkyrie. Mm. What are some techniques that people use if they would like to go about waking their own sleeping Valkyrie?
Right. So the technique that we use in Volvastav is the use of the wooden staff and a wooden stick on a wooden floor to start creating rhythm and to start creating rhythm that's in alignment with your breath. So as you begin to breathe and just gently tapping the staff on the floor and using the tane or the cross stick to create rhythm. And then you can just start to just use your voice, spirit, will, and holiness, the breath, the inspiration that comes from your low gut and lets you go ha, ha, ah at will. It's your will center. And then in it, letting it move into your heart space and open up. And think of yourself as a user of voice and aligning with the World Tree and aligning with spirit, will, and holiness, world, really, and they, in this process. When we are born, we inhale. It's the first thing we do, and that makes us alive. So don't neglect the sound on the inhale. If you go to Scandinavia or parts where old Scandinavians live in North Dakota and places, you'll hear them as they taco, yeah, 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 yeah. And they'll do an inhale kind of a sound. So the sound on the inhale, when you are making a sound on the inhale, it proves you are alive.
Mm.
The last thing we do in our lives is exhale. And everyone's going to do that.
Mm.
And we made a sound when we were born, a sound on the inhale that belongs to us, the sound that is the vibration that keeps our mind, body, and spirit complex together.
Mm.
So if we can find our unique sound that holds our mind, body, and spirit complex together and aligns us with the World Tree, we will meet our Valkyrie. We will meet that blessed lady of the golden light that holds the wisdom cup to us.
Mm. How beautiful. I can think of no better way to bring this conversation to a close. That was really, really beautiful. Thank you so much, Kari, for coming on and educating us and for doing the work that you're doing. It's so important.
Well, thank you so much for reaching out and for having me on your podcast. And I'm really encouraged by the questions you've asked and by the work you're doing. I think you're spot on, and just keep up your good work.
Yes, for sure. And like I said, please keep me posted when you do the fundraiser for the sauna, because I would like to support.
Thank you. I will.
Yes. All right. Awesome. Thanks. Well, have a beautiful rest of your day.
Thank you. And good Yule to you.
Yes. Good Yule to you as well.
See you soon.
All right. Bye now.
coming for to carry me.
Sweet.